You're listening to Dogcast Radio on www.dogcastradio.com.
Some dogs look at you like you're insane.
Notice your dog's intelligence is different to yours.
We're killing our dogs. Wild and Woolly welcome wagon.
The outside of a dog is really, really good. The inside of a person.
Hello and welcome to episode 84 of Dogcast Radio. In this episode, we have the second part of Jerry Wolff's interview on raising puppies.
Puppies that imprint on humans are the problem dogs because they don't realize they're a dog. They don't know how to interact with dogs. They're the ones with all the behavior problems.
We have the concluding part of our fiction feature, Journey. And before all that, we have an interview with shepherd, border collie expert and author, Graham Sims. His latest book is called Give a Dog a Home and deals with some of the problems rescue dogs can encounter. I started by telling Graham what I thought about the book.
I really enjoyed this book because it was entertaining, it was educational, and also it made me laugh, but it did make me cry. Partly, I think, because the love between you and the dogs is so evident, and it's sort of, as a dog owner, it gets you in the heart, you know, you know that relationship. So it was very enjoyable.
I think the reason for that is I'm probably as reserved, though you wouldn't think so, as the next English person, but I'm 72. And if you're 72, you do your maths, and you say, I won't be here for that much longer. So this is the one time in my life I can say what I think, and I can be weak enough to be emotional, and I can allow the tears to flow down my face, and I can hope they're going to run down your cheeks as well. So I let myself go a bit on this one and wrote it the way I think it is. I think a dog is holy in my experience. And if I look back on my life, the most important things that have ever happened to me have usually involved a black nose and a dog. So I was just elevating them to their rightful position.
Yeah. Now, you have quite a broad definition of rescue dog in the book. So can you unpack that for us a bit?
Yes. Commercial greed took a big hand in this because I thought people would say, oh, no, I don't want this book because my dog is not a rescue dog. And I'm saying, a rescue dog in the classic sense is one that somebody else decided not to have and you took over, you rescued it. A rescue dog could also be a dog that you've mistrained for the last 3 years and only just realised your mistakes. So you have to rescue it from this regime that it did not enjoy before. Or a rescue dog might be a psychologically disturbed dog that you've only just realised is psychologically disturbed and now you're going to give it the right treatment. So it's really saying there are many, many dogs and many, many situations that could form the rescue dog, as I'm writing about.
Yeah. Now, another thing that you talk about in this book is the magic button theory, which is really interesting. What's the magic button theory?
Well, in the advertising industry, and I work for all sorts of people. The people I liked a little bit, I did good work for. The people I didn't like at all, I did shoddy work for. And the people I loved, I did the best work I could possibly do. And the reason I did it was when I finished the work, they would still be as nice as they were before. They'd pat me on the back. They'd be my good pal, my loving friend. And I just thought to myself, who would you work best for? Somebody you love dearly or somebody you can't stand? So a lot of common sense in there. If you love a dog to bits, it's going to return that love. Love is reciprocal. Love is a trade. Mm. It's one of the few trading items that a dog understands every bit as well as you do. Mm. So you can just, you don't need a special language, you just trade love.
Yeah.
Somebody once said to me, when I was getting another dog, how can you possibly love another one? Well, I had 16 at the time, and this was going to be 17. And I worried about it. I thought, crikey, how am I going to love another one? And the answer is you have a limitless store of love, and adding another one as a recipient is a doddle. Anybody can do it. We've all got love. It's the only thing, I say, this till it makes me sick, it's the only thing you can continually give away and have more left at the end than you started with.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Here we are.
Definitely. Now, another behaviour that you do, that you say, and you use this with caution, is the sniffing noses greeting.
You've got some good questions. yeah, I say it because I'm trying to be cautious on other people's behalves. There are natural owners of dogs, natural dog people, and there are people who will never be natural but might get close to it. And I've got, I hate to say this, an ability with dogs that I'm absolutely rock certain about. And I know I can walk up to the most savage dog in the world and kiss him on the end of the nose and he won't bite me back. And the reason he won't bite me back is because he's saying, this is a dog who's totally confident in itself. People get mugged and victimised, I'm sure, because they are presented. They present themselves as nature's victims. I remember once a chap on the train saying, oh, we got mugged last night. This was a designer. We got mugged. I said, how many of you were there? He said, three. And I said, how many muggers were there? He said, three. And I said, so why didn't you fight them off? And that question obviously reached an area that he'd never considered. And I thought, he's one of life's victims. You might get my wallet, but by golly, you're going to be scarred by the time you get it.
Yes, I'll give you a run for your money.
Oh, most certainly.
Yes, yes, or a run for mine.
So dogs recognise with that kind of body language those who really have what it takes and those that don't have what it takes. So whilst I'm confident to walk up to any dog and kiss it on the end of the nose, I'm saying to somebody who's not that experienced with dogs, no, don't do it because it is dangerous.
Mm.
And I haven't always come off unscathed. I have been bitten on the nose. Because I did it, but it's not going to stop me doing it, because it's the fast track to a total understanding. The minute the dog says, yes, I know this person, it's going to love that person. I have a lot of emails that come through and people say, what should I do with this dog, and how do I do this, and how do I do that? And in the very question they're asking me, they reveal the reason that it's going wrong. One man said, my dog bites my coat, pulls, does this, that and the other when we're out walking. And he didn't do that in the garden when we were playing with his toy. Well, the question must be, what sort of game were you playing with your toy that taught the dog that this is fair game to do this? So a lot of people are doing all sorts of things wrong that they would consider classically right, but they're actually wrong. All you're asking them to do is to be open-minded enough to consider that what you're saying might be true.
Yeah.
So hence the sniffing on the nose and so forth.
Yeah. Now, another technique that may be transferable to other people, presumably, is the sausage treatment.
Oh, yes, the sausage treatment. Yes. This is a great benefit, of course, because you get some of the sausage too. I started doing it when, in the last book I wrote about away days, where you take your dog, a dog that you're having problems with, take it away and lavish your care and attention on it. And I used to do that with dogs that were very, very nervous. And because I had to go and do a show on the Saturday, I'd often take the caravan down on the Friday, settle it into the best spot, because you've got to travel from the caravan to the arena. You want that to be trouble-free, and you want room to park and so forth. So I always just take the most nervous dog with me. And we set the caravan out, and we'd wander around, and we'd do our own thing, and be totally leisurely. And then we'd have sausage, warm bread with butter, which is very, very nice. The sausage will all be cut up. The bread will be cut up into squares. And I put the plate on the floor and we share it. And the amazing thing is you would say, a dog will eat all the sausage and the bread up before you even get near it. No, the dog didn't. And I didn't have to teach it. The dog had a slice, I had a slice. The dog had a piece, I had a piece. And so it went on. When we got back, that dog was mine. That dog was mine. And it didn't say to itself either, as humans would, oh, we didn't do it this Friday. Oh, he hasn't repeated it since then. It happened. That's enough for a dog. It happened once. So the sausage was a magic way of saying to the dog, when neither of you speak each other's language, here, I love you enough to give you some of my food. If you put that into context, there isn't an alpha dog in the world that's going to give another dog any of its food. So this is a miracle in dog terms. Maybe not in human, but in dog terms.
Well, you see, I would share sausage, but it would be a miracle if I shared chocolate. That would be different. Yeah.
But I doubt whether they grasp the subtlety. Although they might, of course. Yeah.
Yes, it depends. Now, you use a three-layered system to instruct the dogs, to get the instruction in, which is a mirror of what the dogs use, or what wolves use.
Yes. Yes, so, again, common sense. If you're close up, you're close enough to see each other's body language. If you're in the mid-distance, you might, and dogs don't have good eyesight, probably they won't see your body language. Maybe if your eyesight isn't too good, you won't see theirs. So you use an audible sound. So you call in your voice, Bob, Ben, whatever. When it gets to maybe 3/4 of a mile and there's a wind blowing, a bit of a gale, you're not going to hear each other at all. So I use then a sheepdog whistle, that will go for 3 miles on a calm day and at least a mile on a very, very stormy day. High-frequency sound, which the dog's good at hearing, and they'll hear that. Now, the problem is to link the three. So what it is, if I'm getting a dog to run round me to the left or the right, I first of all use body language, which would be to turn my whole body in the direction I want them to travel. And what they'll do is say, where have his eyes gone? The only system, the way of judging his mood is to look at his eyes. So they'll run round to get themselves into a position to see my eyes. Then I just simply keep turning. And they'll keep running around and see where the eyes are, so that they're always in the perfect position, because dogs are very canny. And then I'll add a word. Come by. Run clockwise. Come by. Come by. When we've done that a million times, I'll do the body language, the movement, which you can't hear on the radio, but the movement, and then the sound, come by, come by. Then I'll add a whistle. So, 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 so. And they'll say, they'll make the connection between these three layers or laminations. And then, later on, when they're really experienced and they're 3 miles away and I whistle without any of the other two, they'll say, I know what that means. That means I come back, or I run to the right, or I run to the left, or whatever it is. So that's why I do it. There's a new system, I think, of teaching children of using phonetical spellings to arrive at the same end. And that's done in stages. And I think that works very, very well. And Welsh, we're in Wales now, is a phonetical language. And because it's phonetical, it's easy to grasp. You don't have to worry about the structure of it, how it's built or why. You just listen to the sound. The name of this house is Gan Vawr. Gan Vawr. And it means the huge pile of stones. Is easy. Gan Vawr. And I use that kind of same system with the dog, so that I try and make each lesson as easily understood as I possibly can.
Yeah, yeah. Now, something I'm always told off for by trainers I work with is talking to the dog too much, because I want to feed back to him. But you say in the book, don't babble.
Yeah, I've got to be fair about this. I'm talking about me training border collies. So, no, don't babble, because it's confusing. Say left, right, sit, stand. As clearly as that. Afterwards, say, I love you to bits because you're a lovely furry, kiss, 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 cuddle, cuddle, cuddle. There was a wonderful moment at the Welsh National that I absolutely loved, where all these wonderful Welsh hill farmers were running their dogs immaculately through the most difficult course I've ever seen in my life. And when they came back to the post in front of the stadium, they reached down and patted the dog once, and I thought, you heartless toads. Then I watched them around the back of the refreshment tent, and they were all over them. I love you to bits, kiss, 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 cuddle, cuddle, cuddle. Big contrast there between that and how they were on the field. On the field, they said, come by. No discussion about it. Come by. Dog will understand that. I recognise those words. Come by. Run to the left. I understand that.
Yeah.
So it's really about not confusing the dog. And a dog that yip, 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 yips all the time confuses you. So imagine how confusing it is when you're doing the same thing back to the dog. There's that classic, isn't there, about the dog runs away. The lady runs after it, shouting, come back, come back, come back, come back, come back. And the dog doesn't read it as the human intended, but as, my goodness, my human's having a good time. Yeah, they're running with me and they're barking.
Yeah.
So, confusion.
Yeah, so we're playing, this is great.
Yes, we're playing. Yeah, yeah. Mixed message, yeah.
The other thing that I picked up from the book is you must spend a huge amount of time with your dogs, and within that time, you put a huge emphasis on grooming.
Yes, and we're sitting out. For the people that are listening to this program, we're sitting in the lounge, and I've got three dogs here, And if you look down at them, are they well-groomed? Yes.
Yes.
So it isn't just empty words.
Oh, no.
I groom them all the time because I think it's better than cuddling. I think it's much, much better than cuddling. If you groom a dog, you take all of the irritations away from it. You're bonding with it. You're taking all those little bits of bramble and thorn and grit and so forth that when they lay it down, they're going to be terribly uncomfortable. You're freeing the whole thing up and giving them a lovely coat, and you're paying them attention. Mm-hmm. So I think it's the... I honestly think it's one of the greatest cures for most problems. Grooming.
Yeah.
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 I probably haven't said enough about it, but... Yeah, I think it's that simple.
Yeah.
It's that simple.
Yeah. And they definitely enjoy it because, I mean, that my dog is a Labrador, so he's short-coated, he's easy maintenance, drip-dry, you know. He doesn't actually need a lot of grooming. I mean, he sheds heavily, but he doesn't actually mat or anything, so, he, you know. Our other dog is a Bichon, so she has to be sort of really well brushed every day. And he will sit waiting for his turn and go, can I have some now? Can I have some? So they definitely value it, don't they, from their point of view?
Yeah, I've noticed that Bendy, who is the rescue dog, when I first started grooming him, hated it. And even it's taken, this is what, I'm talking about 4 years later. If we go in the field now and I groom all of the others, it doesn't take him long to come over and say, go on, give me a turn, give me a turn. He even offers me the bit he'd like me to comb. So he values it. I twiddle his ears and I fondle his head and all the rest of it, but the thing he really loves is being groomed.
Yeah.
That's what he loves. Yeah. And I don't know why, because dogs in the wild wouldn't sit there for ages grooming each other. No. The monkeys would, dogs wouldn't, but they like it. I think it's one service that we, because we've got a thumb that controls things, can actually offer to the dog that they can't supply themselves. That's probably why it's so valuable.
Yeah. The main meat of the book, really, is you take two rescue dogs.
Yes.
And you sort of rehabilitate them.
Yes.
And set about sort of training them not, as you say, not to be the best behaved dog, but to be the happiest dog.
Yes.
Yeah. So can you tell us about Kerry first?
Yes, I can. Kerry was rescued from somebody who did not understand the needs that border collies have. While he was at that person's house, somebody did something nasty to him, something physical to him. I don't think the man that owned him did it. I think it was probably told me a story about some people that came to chop down some trees at the end of the garden. Somebody frightened the life out of him on one day. And his attitude towards me when I took him back was, he's nice now, he was nice yesterday. He was nice the day before, but don't you believe he'll be nice tomorrow or in the next minute. So there was always this, he's going to assume his normal human trait of being nasty. And it's taken years and years to break this down. And he was always so aware of it that I figured that I had to put something more exciting than that danger in place of it. So what I did was I put the ducks in. And the minute he realised that he had this power to work ducks, two things happened. One, he lost all of the fears, didn't have time for fears and working the ducks, so he threw the fears away, they were the least valuable, and he worked on the ducks. And the more it happened, and the more he was able to respond to my, come by, away here, move them on, lay down, get up, and all the rest of it, he became totally confident. And now that last bit of fear has all but gone. Word of caution, it'll never go. It'll never go. I had a mother that wasn't a very nice mother, and as a result, the scars will be with me forevermore. Evermore. I will always have moments where I say, seen that before. Don't trust that. Dogs always have it too. It's the rare dog that'll overcome all of its fears, I think.
You can get it sort of to a level that you can manage. You've managed it, do you think?
I can get it to a level where it's saying, I do have time to enjoy my life. I'm not going to spend all of my time being terrified about what might happen. There's that great difference, isn't there, between the definition of what fear means and anxiety means. I always think anxiety means it might happen. Fear means it has happened and I recognise it's about to happen again. So he had a terrible mixture of fear. I've seen it happen before, it's going to happen again. And anxiety, is this the man that's going to make it happen? So I could remove the pain of those two things and make his life happier.
Yeah. Now, Jack, was a lot harder to work with, wasn't he? It seems.
Yeah, Jack. Jack is a rescue dog in one of the other categories that I hinted at earlier on, in so much as we had him right from the beginning. So we did something wrong. He lived in a kitchen, and there was a boiler in the kitchen, and I hint about that in the book, and the boiler made high-frequency sounds. Something, or water running down the waste pipes, something disturbed him in that house. And he was the most awfully behaved dog you've ever seen. He could eat a wall of plaster in a night. He could wee a Lake Genesaret, you know, a big one. He could sail boats on it in the morning. It was big. And nothing would cure him. He'd also eat his own droppings. All of those things. I wanted to cure those. And when I started, I realised, and it took... You'll notice in there are maybe three chapters where I'm still looking to try and find out what it is that has disturbed Jack. In the end, I found out that he's really worried when it's apparent to him that I'm about to start training. But not worried at all if I take a rake and go to rake some grass up. And in between raking the grass up, say to him, come here, go, lie down, get up, walk on. He says, that's all right. He's not here working me. He's actually working the fields. And then I started thinking, well, that's funny. He recognises the difference between a rake and a crook. Or he recognises the difference in my walk when I'm going with a stick or a walking stick or a sheepdog crook or a spade or a fork. He recognises all the difference. So I did some tall recognition tests with him and noticed that he knew what I was going to do every single time. If I took a fork... He knew not only what I was going to do with the fork, but where I would go with it. So I'd only take a fork to ground that was rough and tough, so it'd be the bottom field, so he'd go down to the bottom field. Gradually, and the hardest moment came when trying to forget all the pretense about raking and all the rest of it and give him an order. And I discovered I could do it, but if I gave him three orders in sequence, he'd return straight back to that nervous and worried state. Something happened, though. He didn't wee anymore. He didn't eat plaster anymore. He didn't eat other dogs' droppings or his own anymore. And I'd done something else. At the same time as starting to train Jack, I'd put him in his own outdoor run. I'd gone down the road and I'd bought 12 bales of the best meadow hay. And I'd made his bed 2 foot deep in meadow hay, which is beautifully fragrant. When he comes out in the morning, or as he runs by, I can smell him. He smells delicious. Those things all happened at the same time. So, A, he didn't like living where he was in this kitchen with all these terrible noises, being restrained. B, he did like living in this lovely meadow, fresh place where he could come out in the middle of the night and smell the air and listen to the animals making noises. And that and the training cured him. But it cured him less than it cured Kerry. He's nearly cured, but the scars will be even more marked with Jack till the end of his time. And then I started saying to myself, are there disturbed people and disturbed dogs? And does it have to be something that caused them to be disturbed? Aren't they just, couldn't they just be mentally slightly unwell? And I think the answer must be yes, and Jack's probably one of those. The most frustrating thing is I will never, ever know what caused it.
Yeah.
I will never, ever know if I caused it. And that's quite worrying. So there's only one way out of a terrible set of circumstances like that, and that is that I can put my hand on my heart and say, is he a happy dog? And the answer is yes. That's enough. That's enough. If I work him with all of the other dogs, he's very, very capable. He can do everything they can do, and he can do it wonderfully. If ever I said to them, you go home, and I'm just going to work Jack on his own, we'd have a nervous breakdown. I probably made that, the answer to that question is probably torturous, and I probably haven't answered it properly. And the truth is, I don't know the answer, but I've gone as far towards where I think it might be as I can.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, one of the things that you say make very clear about the Border Collies is that work is calming for them. You'll never calm them by sort of saying, oh, cook them up and don't stimulate them.
No, you and I, you and I both belong to the same forum.
Yes.
And there are certain people on the forum that believe in magic touching and... calming and cuddles and all sorts of newfangled toys and contraptions and so forth to calm their border collie. What they're actually doing when they're calming a border collie a border collie with a working heritage, is driving into a state of total frustration and mental illness, because the border collie has been designed for hundreds of years to work. The thing that's going to satisfy it most is to give it work. I'll give you an example. I wanted to be an artist when I was young, and my father said to me, no, you never make any money at that, go and be a chef. So I got a sitting girls, Cordon Bleu, all the rest of it, and I worked at the Ritz and the Café Royal. I hated every single minute of it. I probably behaved badly, I was ill at ease, I did not like it. After a bit, I said to myself, I can't stand this anymore, I'm going to go and do the thing I wanted to do in the first place. And I became an artist. I was as happy as a sandboy, because I was doing what my genes were telling me to do. And that's what it is with the border collie. Don't you come along later on and say, oh, I'm the new sophisticated owner, I knew all about it. Say to yourself, first of all, where did this dog come from? Why is he like he is? Why does he like work so much? Discover what his heritage is and then give him lots of work, and you won't have a furniture-eating monster. You'll have a very laid-back and easy-going dog, because he's getting a lot of what he wants.
Now, you also mentioned really fascinating things about how dogs interact with other dogs. I mean, you talk about sort of the fact that dogs won't... When Binky came to the house, when your daughter's beagle came to the house, and he and the other dogs in the house just sorted it out like that while the humans were still talking about it. And the other thing that you've observed with your pack is they don't necessarily, although they know, they acknowledge relations, like relationships sort of like that's mum or, you know, and sort of give that respect due. They don't necessarily choose their friends, you know, their relations as their friends, do they?
No, there's a kind of puzzling attitude. Little Sally outside knows Kerry and will reprimand him, because Kerry's her son. She knows that. She won't sit next to him or be nice to him, ever. And all of the dogs will ignore each other. And the worst thing in the whole wide world is that one dog who wasn't fit to lick the boots of another one in its prime will suddenly start getting snotty with it because it was old. There's no recognition there. They won't say, well, crikey, I admired him so much when he was young, I wouldn't possibly insult, you know, him. I'm not fit to lick his boots. We would say that. But dogs don't say that. But then you get a strange moment where little Fady died on New Year's Eve, and she was going blind, so her eyes went milky, and she had an advanced form of diabetes. And she felt the cold very, very badly, and she had to go to the loo every 5 minutes and so forth. So it really disturbed life enormously. I was up and down there all night and all day. And I put Gemma in with her. Now, Gemma didn't show any signs of impatience. Gemma looked after her all day long, cuddled her, kept her warm, ushered her along so she didn't bump into things, and really looked after her. Gemma is her mother. Mm-hmm. I don't think that's got much to do with it. It might do, it might not. But I have noticed, watching the pack, that there are very, very kind dogs and dogs who are not kind at all. Gemma is the dog I always put sick dogs in with. Poor Gemma. She's everybody's nurse. Old Bob, he had a stroke last year. If he's cold, I put him in with Gemma. She'll look after him. There are just kind dogs. There are the three I've got in this room. The one over there, Ben, who's an old dog, is very, very kind. Mm. The one that I got in between my knees, Misty, is a real snot. You know, if anybody gets in the way or does anything he doesn't like, they'll know the price. Yeah. Little one down here, just laying next to me, is Susie, who's one of the most nervous of the lot. And she's kind when she feels assured enough to be so. But if danger strikes, you'll suddenly see a very different dog indeed. Yeah. So if I went through all of my dogs and I said, I've got 12 dogs now, how many kind ones have I got? The answer would really be three. Mm. Three kind dogs. They're all females. I know I said Ben, but Ben lives indoors, so he's kind of removed from that need to live in a pack. But they're markedly inconsiderate and unkind to a dog that's ill. Mm. I mean, most male dogs will say to themselves, this dog used to be able to beat me up, but now it's old and doddery. I can beat it up, so I will. Mm. And I find that very, very strange, because if I were to put a puppy down amongst them all, they'd all be kissing and cuddling the puppy and looking after it. Yeah. Except for Gemma, and I cannot understand yet, I hope I will, why she should be so kind and considerate, and so reliably kind and considerate. I haven't answered the question at all. I don't know the answer to the question. It's just an observation. Because I spend so much time with my dogs, as you said, I'm watching them all of the time, and I'm seeing things happening. Sometimes I can get an answer to what I see happening fairly quickly, and sometimes I never get an answer to what I see is happening. And I think the thing that most of us dog trainers, the mistake we all make is the one where we assume we know the answers. The truth is we don't know any of the answers. We get little hints. That's all we get. You'd have to live for several hundred years to get all the answers.
There's a lovely section in the book where a farmer is asking you about sort of how many sheep you have, and you tell him, but they're all retired. And then he asks you about your ducks, and you say, yeah, well, but they're all retired. And then, well, how many dogs have you got? And you tell him, but you don't breed anymore. You don't breed dogs anymore. And he says, oh, you're going nowhere then.
Yes.
But you point out that you sort of, your focus with the dogs has changed. But also there's a tremendous sense of you and the dogs and all the animals. Somehow you've come home and you've found peace.
Yes, I didn't get the real and the clever answer to the farmer, Lindsay. He won't mind me saying his name. Lindsay's a great dog expert, so I must tell you that first. He's got nearly as many dogs as I've got, and he works in a retreat. He's a sheep farmer, so he knows about such things. He's used to a situation where his money comes from taking animals to market. So he's got sheep, he takes them to market, he gets money. He's got this, he takes it to market, he gets money. So it's probably hard for him to realise what I'm doing with my dogs. When I first started training them, I was blinded by the need to get a task achieved to a degree and a level of perfection that we aspired to, and we managed that. Then as you get older and you come back and you've got all these creatures that are retired, I don't see that I should keep them running around and obey me like mad. We're pals. We've been pals all the way along the line. I want to enjoy my retirement. I want them to enjoy their retirement. So now it's much more about we're pals. There's a downside to all of this, and that is that they're less obedient than they ever were before. When somebody goes past the garden on a tractor or a Land Rover or walks or runs or on a bicycle, this lot go absolutely barmy, and they don't take any notice whatsoever of me calling them back. In the old days, they would have come back instantly. In fact, they wouldn't have barked in the first place. So we've grown closer together, and I spend all of my days looking at them to try and understand them. And because I don't have that much time left, in so much as they're old, I'm old, I'd like the last few years to be absolutely perfect, but I'd like to learn as much as I possibly can about what they're really saying to each other. So everything's changed. There's an interesting point there. A man said to me recently, my dog won't behave himself at all. I've always handled dogs very, very well, and I've done this, and I've done that, and I've done the other, and so forth. And I believe every word he said. And I said to him by email, how old are you now? And he said, 75. And I wrote back and said, your dog recognises it. Just as those dogs in the kennel recognise the moment has come to beat the one that always beat them, a dog will look at its owner and say, he is not the authority he used to be. And they'll play on it. So, did that answer the question?
Yes.
Was that well enough answer? I'm never sure whether I've answered the question properly or not. When I was studying theology, they used to say that I was the student that gave the most brilliant answers to the wrong questions. So, there we are.
Oh, well, I hope you have many more years of happiness here with your dogs.
Thank you very much indeed, and thanks for a nice, kind interview. And with some very penetrating questions. Thank you.
Thanks, Graham.
I think he gave some brilliant answers to the right questions there. It's always a pleasure to meet Graham, his wife Maureen, and their dogs. He's given me some wonderful advice, and he always leaves me thinking too. You can find out more about Graham and his latest book, Give a Dog a Home, at his website, grahamsims.com. I very much believe in rescuing animals, not buying them. Candice Bergen on finding her dog Lois, a terrier basset hound mix.
You're
listening to Dogcast Radio on www.dogcastradio.com. And now, the second part of our fiction feature, which began in the last episode of Dogcast Radio. The Journey, Part 2. Written and read by Julie Hill. It was not an instant connection. There was no magical love-at-first-sight moment when their eyes met, the woman looking for a dog, and the dog looking for a new home. There was very little information about him. He was around a year old. He had been found at the side of the road, tied to a tree. He seemed to be a pedigree Weimaraner, and while he was in good condition, he had virtually no training. He was one of many dogs Debbie met at the shelter. It wasn't love as much as pity that led her to choose him. He was so full of energy, so leggy and clumsy, so completely daft. Who else would be willing to take him? She had a large house and garden. She had experience of Dachshunds and Dalmatians, so she knew about strong-willed, energetic dogs. And since the death of her beloved dog a few months previously, she had a canine-shaped hole in her life and her heart. She named him Billy and set about taming him. He was a strange dog. He was so full of enthusiasm in any outdoor setting, yet so reluctant to approach her in the house. He lay on his bed, eyeing her nervously, as if waiting for something bad to happen. She decided to ignore this behaviour, but it created a very unnatural situation, with hours of them alone together in the house, him watching her anxiously, her pretending not to see him at all. They enrolled in a training class, and with the motivation of food, he progressed well. Once back at the house, they retreated to their separate positions, though. It was frustrating. She wanted to love him, and she wanted him to love her. But instead, in many ways, he seemed to tolerate her. Greetings were muted. He would wag his tail from his bed, without getting off it, as she returned home. However, she knew full well that he had left his bed while she was out, from the damage he did while left alone. Separation anxiety. She consulted a behaviourist, began to accustom him to the fact that she left, but always returned. Left him with distraction toys, a radio on quietly, and none of it made a jot of difference. If he was left alone, he seemed to go mad, running round the house, knocking over anything unsecured, chewing whatever he felt like, occasionally toileting inside her house. She never scolded him for it, but her body language, as she cleared up his mayhem, spoke volumes to him. She was angry, he knew, and he curled on his bed, cringing with his back to her. No amount of talking to him in a gentle voice coaxed him to her or assuaged his fears. Luckily, she worked from home, and she began to contrive that she left the house less and less. The only times he really chose to interact with her were walks and training classes, when the lure of a toy to retrieve or a tasty treat proved too much for him to resist. But she doubted there was any affection in it. It was too hard. Every day involved so much hard work, such effort. Her social life was dwindling, and for what? A dog that didn't even love or apparently even like her. She persisted with him, partly because she hoped she would work him out, find the key to his particular problem, and partly through stubbornness, that she would not admit defeat. She determinedly showed him only kindness and tenderness, trying to atone for the abandonment, and who knew what else he had already suffered. She continued to ignore his anxiety in the house, hoping not to reinforce it. He had learned his lesson too well, though. He had displeased his old pack with his riotous behaviour in the house. He would not make the same mistake with this new one. So he lay in miserable isolation on his bed, waiting, while Debbie sat in her chair, ignoring. When she grew tired of never seeing her friends, she arranged to meet up with some of them for a coffee at a nearby cafe where she knew they could sit outside, meaning she could take Billy with her. He trotted quite happily at her side as they walked to the cafe and stood beside her as she greeted her friends. "Hold him for a second while I pop to the loo," she said, and passed Billy's lead to a friend. Billy watched her as she walked the short distance to the shop front. He whined. He lunged forward, and the friend, unprepared for such a strong pull, felt the lead slip through his fingers. Billy had lost one pack this way. Sitting crying while they disappeared, he would not lose another the same way. With no thought of the consequences, no room in his mind for the fear of being rejected, no other idea in his head but to avoid losing sight of his person, he bounded across the pavement and leapt at Debbie. His long legs enabled his paws to reach her shoulders, and he stretched his head up to lick her repeatedly on the face, neck, head, anywhere he could reach. She staggered backwards against the shop front, and they ended up in a heap on the ground. She was laughing and encouraged. He was licking and leaping around her in excitement that he had prevented her from leaving him. And even better, she did not seem inclined to punish his exuberance. She put her arms round him as joyful tears ran down her face, only to be eagerly licked away before they reached halfway down her cheek. Nothing that had gone before mattered. He was hers and she was his. From now on, they would both know that. The hardest part of the journey was done. The rest might not be plain sailing, but at least now they would be steering the same course. Thank God I got the rejects. These animals are very, very affectionate. Eartha Kitt, about her two poodles who weren't up to the breeder's standards. Jerry Wolfe is a Cairn Terrier breeder who has a fantastic approach to raising puppies. In the last episode of Dogcast Radio, she talked about how she allows her dogs space to behave naturally. This is the second half of that interview, and we start by talking about how much you can learn from watching your dogs.
Yeah, if you just sit and watch. You know, that's how I judge, grade puppies for who's going to be kept to be shown. Which ones should go to an older couple? Which ones should go to a younger couple with children? If you just sit there and watch and see how they react to each other, because you're going to see which one is dominant right away. You're going to see which one is the one that is always into things, the one that's laid back. You know, you can read all of that in the puppies just by sitting and watching them.
Yeah. Obviously, you do watch them and you do spend an awful lot of time with them. And I notice in the article you say, you know, I don't just dump them outside and let them get on with it. It is, you know, you are there. But within that context of you watching them, you give them their space, don't you?
Yeah. You're an observer. Yeah, I very, very seldom have ever had to stop and interfere. But it's like my girls are such good whelpers. I would never let one of them have puppies without me being around. You know, so I'm always there, but I try to interfere as least the less amount as possible. That's another whole subject, but, you know, the whole thing has gotten so convoluted with, I truly believe artificial insemination has its place, using frozen semen has its place, but it shouldn't replace our dog being allowed to breed naturally, to whelp naturally, to raise their puppies naturally.
Yeah.
You know, if you have a female that is just nasty in fights, and usually these are ones that were never allowed to know they weren't the center of attention, center of the world.
Yeah.
And you have to AI her because you can't trust her with the male. I'm sorry, she shouldn't be bred.
No.
But, you know, it's gotten so common for some people, that's all they do is all they will artificially inseminate. They don't allow their dogs to breed because they might hurt each other. Well, how do you know what kind of temperament you're breeding if you are doing this all artificially for them?
No, exactly.
We're their supervisors, so to speak, but we shouldn't make them so artificial that they lose the ability to breed on their own. They lose the ability to whelp on their own. But you got to kind of draw a line on how far you should interfere.
Yeah. I was going to say, do you think that if more breeders used at least some of these methods, you know, even the ones if they say, well, no, I can't go all that way, you know, all, you know, hand over that much to the dogs. But if we saw people, you know, taking steps along this way to let the dogs take over some of it again and have this socialisation and this time and this autonomy, do you think that would improve dog temperaments generally?
Yes, most definitely. You know, you can't, and I think I say this in my article too, you know, you can't just go, okay, do it all on your own. You know, if you have animals that weren't raised the way I raised mine, it's going to take a generation or two for them to adapt over because it's all been done for them. And it's, you know, there are people that cannot put their males out with their females. I manage a boarding kennel. You know, we never put a male, two males next to each other, even if they're neutered. And that's just in case.
Yes.
You know, not that you couldn't, but why risk it? You know, we do have animals that, yeah, live together, that are boarded together in the same room and patio, but, you know, it's something you just can't say, okay, I'm changing my ways, let's do it a new way, but using bits and pieces until you're comfortable with it, then, you know, eventually change over, it would work.
Yeah.
And I've no doubt that temperaments would improve.
It's a fascinating area, and when I started to search on it, yours was the only article, the only mention in a positive way of letting, you know, more than just the mother raise the puppy. So it's definitely not widely accepted, is it?
No, it's not. You know, and I get phone calls from people that have bought dogs for me and going, oh, the puppies are fighting. I can't keep these two boys together. And I go, leave them alone.
Yeah.
Just leave them alone. Every time you go in and rescue one or the other one takes that as they won. And it gets worse and it gets worse and it gets worse. It's like the owners that come in when, and I also do grooming, you know, and they want to stay and watch, and they're sitting there as the dog is having a complete meltdown being groomed, and they're saying, oh, it's okay, it's okay. No, it's not okay. It's the wrong behavior. Don't reward bad behavior.
Yeah.
We tend to humanize our dogs way too much.
Yeah. Do you think some of it as well is, you know, people don't read the behavior well enough? So, because sometimes when dogs interact, obviously they snarl and they growl and there's teeth, you know, and you need to be able to look for the signs so that you can see, oh no, he's doing a play bow as well, or his tail is nice and loose and wagging, or, you know, whatever it is. So that you can, you can see what is actually going on between them and whether you need to wade in or not.
Yeah. And it's a whole lot of us learning how to read them and allowing them to learn to read each other. And it's a hard transition for a lot of people. You got to let them do it.
Yeah. Do you know of anybody else who has similar methods?
Only those people that have gotten dogs for me.
So if they've seen it works, they're willing to try it, but that's as far as we've got so far.
Yeah. You know, I'm sure there are quite a, actually, the my that article gets passed around a whole lot, so I'm sure there's other people that are that have tried it, but I just don't know any of them personally. At about the same time, you contacted me. One of the kennel clubs in Colorado contacted me as well and wanted to know if I could come do a seminar for them. And I did do a seminar in Hawaii a few years back. But it, you know, like I say in my article, you know, try it. It really does work.
Yeah. Yeah. When you've done the seminars, sort of what feedback do you get? Do people sort of have I might try that? Or do they sort of go, no, are they quite, you know, dismissive?
Most of them have been kind of receptive, saying, well, gee, you know, maybe that, you know, it makes sense. Maybe it would work. But like I say, I never get that much feedback later on.
No. You see, I've posted on a couple of forums and sort of said, you know, here's an idea. What do you think of this? And one lady said she has miniature poodles. And she said, oh, yes, mm-hmm. my male is very soft and, you know, he will go in. But the other thing that she said was her breeding pair is bonded. She has two dogs. They're bonded as a pair. They live together. And, you know, maybe that's the reason her bitch tolerates the dog going in. You know, and I wonder if that's another factor. What do you do? Are your breeding pairs bonded or are they not? How does that work for you?
No, because I very seldom use one of my own stud dogs.
Oh, right.
I usually will use somebody else's or the dog, or if it is one that I bred, he doesn't live with me.
Yeah, yeah.
In fact, my last litter was sired by a dog that lives in Denmark that I bred.
Mm, wow.
That's one thing that's great about the internet, the way it is nowadays, because we can make connections with people much further away. So there's really, and like I said earlier, you know, there's always a reason to use artificial insemination, but, you know, it shouldn't be a way of life. And that's because, you know, this dog's in Denmark. And not everybody can just stop what they're doing and run to go have a girl bred.
No, no.
But this allows us to use dogs that before it would have been impossible to access.
Yeah.
You know, we can breed to a dog in Sweden. We can breed to a dog in Japan without ever having to send a girl. Yeah, and I have people send me girls all the time, and I usually let them live together.
Yeah.
And get to know each other.
Mm. So it's not just sort of a, there you are, get on with it, and whisked away. It's sort of a...
Yeah.
Yeah.
They get to run together. They get to play together. He gets to romance her. And some stud dogs can be very sweet. little kisses in the ears and a nibble on the neck.
Oh, I know you have a lot of information sort of about what you actually do as well with the puppies to, you know, ensure that you, there's sort of a week by week guide, isn't there? About sort of what to do with the puppies every week.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And a lot of handling. They're weighed daily. You play with their feet. You stress them a little bit, you know, on a from the day they're born.
Mm.
Holding the puppies upside down, holding them on their back. But the sooner they learn how to deal with stress, the better they handle stress when they're older in life.
Mm.
You know, so putting their feet on a wet towel, a Q-tip between their paw pads. It's another thing, terriers are notoriously bad at having their nails trimmed.
Mm.
None of this helps that. They just hate having their feet messed with. And I really think it has to do with them always... To them, that's their livelihood or their nails.
Yes.
And they don't want you removing them because they want as much nail as they can for all that digging and hunting they're supposed to be up to.
Yes, yeah. Oh. While you're doing this with the puppies, you know, and obviously you do an awful lot of work with them, what age do your puppies leave you at?
My puppies don't leave until they're 16 weeks old.
Oh, wow. Now, that's quite late. So why is that?
Because, number one, they go through a couple of trainers back in the 60s said, oh, you have to place puppies by 8 weeks old so they can bond with the new owners.
Hmm.
The only thing, the way of raising puppies from the 50s and 60s to nowadays has changed greatly. Back in the old days, puppies, most people had kennels.
Hmm.
The puppies were born and raised in the kennel. The only time they were, especially hunting breeds, the only time they saw humans was when their caregiver came in to clean and feed.
Mm.
And so they were just kind of left in with mom and roughhoused, and they didn't see anything until they got their first vaccinations. Then they were allowed out to play, but they didn't have a whole lot of interaction with humans.
Mm.
And the days of the big old kennels are gone, and I would say 80% of all puppies from concerned breeders are raised, you know, born in their house somewhere, you know, either their garage or their living room, or in my case, my bedroom, you know, and they're handled constantly.
Mm.
And we really do not want puppies to bond or imprint on humans. The puppies that imprint on humans are the problem dogs, because they don't realize they're a dog. They don't know how to interact with dogs. They're the ones with all the behavior problems. So puppies at around 8 weeks old actually go through a fear period. If they're allowed to stay with their mother and siblings and maybe a couple of other pack members, they can go through that fear period without being traumatized.
Mm.
Puppies that are moved to a new home during this, you know, what if you could do something like drop a frying pan?
Mm-hmm.
And that puppy could be imprinted for life for the fear of loud noises.
Yeah.
But if they have their support group around them during that fear period, those big noises, big changes, they adapt to more readily because they have a support group.
Yeah.
They have their mother and siblings to say, oh, that's okay. Nothing big.
Yeah.
And move through it. But, you know, again, you know, compare it to the same as a child, you know, being frightened of something and not having somebody there to help you through the fright.
Yeah.
You know, it's more traumatic if you have to deal with it on your own.
Yeah.
You know, so just think of being taken away from your support group, put into a strange environment with strangers and something strange happening. You know, it can scar them for life.
Yeah. Yeah. So all that stress, when we do rehouse puppies at 8 weeks, all that stress is at exactly the wrong time, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, and they're, you know, and it's at about 8 weeks that the mother's immunity is just starting to drop off.
Yeah.
And if even though you have vaccinated, the mother's immunity interferes with the vaccination from taking effect,
mm-hmm.
which is why we do multiple vaccinations, because we don't know when mom's immunity is going to drop and the vaccinations take over. Scientists have now told us, well, it's probably somewhere around 8 weeks old.
Mm.
You know, so not only the fear period, you're also moving this puppy to another environment that is not totally protected from disease, from vaccinations. You're putting him into a stress situation for them, which interferes with your immunity as well. You know, everybody knows if you're stressed out, it's much easier to catch a cold than it is. You know, so that 8 weeks, I just can't agree.
Yeah, yeah. So why have you settled on 16 weeks?
Because I had at one time, years and years ago, I had a litter of puppies at 14 weeks old come down with parvo. There were three puppies in the litter. They had all been vaccinated from the same, because I do my own vaccinations. It was all the same lot number. Everything was done exactly the same for all three puppies. One puppy got it and died. One puppy got parvo, was sick for a few days and recovered. The third puppy never got parvo and was never affected. So you don't, and it was in that window between when mom's immunity dropped off and the vaccinations took over, and all three puppies had the exact same vaccine at the exact same age. So how do you know? You know, you could run titers on every single puppy, but that would be quite expensive. I just had two cats titered to go to Australia, and it was like $600 for two cats.
Wow. So that's not realistic, is it, now?
You know, there are times I'll let them go at 12 to 14 weeks, but I have to really know the people and the situation. You know, but there's a whole bunch of things involved, not just the raising and the... It's all intertwined in one big puzzle.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, that's been a fascinating insight into your methods and how your dogs are brought up. That was brilliant. Can you give us the web address where people can find your article?
It's at www.rose-croft.com.
I found Jerry's knowledge of and approach to raising puppies really interesting. I hope you did too. You can find out more about Jerry and her Cairn Terriers and read her article giving more detail about raising puppies at her website, rosecroft.com. She had no particular breed in mind, no unusual requirements, except the special sense of mutual recognition that tells dog and human they have both come to the right place. Lloyd Alexander. I was contacted by Sue Cole, who is a teacher at a UK school and also the leader of the Sofa Club, which is a group of 9 to 14-year-olds who are seeking to make microchipping of dogs a legal requirement. I think this would be an excellent piece of legislation. It would ensure many dogs are reunited with their owners and encourage responsible dog ownership. I'm hoping to catch up with the Sofa Group at Crufts and talk to them about their campaign. There's only one episode of Dogcast Radio this month, as I'm having some time off to celebrate my birthday in style. And no, I'm not going to reveal which birthday it is. We'll see you in April with our Crufts coverage and an interview with Tim and Kathy Glass about the book that tells their moving story, Just This Side of Heaven. Till next time, look after yourselves and your dogs. Thanks for listening to Dogcast Radio, available from www.dogcastradio.com. That's dogcastradio.com. If you'd like to get in touch with us, and wherever you are in the world, we'd love to hear from you. You can do so in a variety of ways. By phone from the UK, you can contact us on 0121-288-0922. From the US, you can contact us on our American number, which is 315-849-2022. From any other country, you'll need your international exit code and then 44121-288-0922. You can contact us on Skype with the ident Dogcast Radio. That's all one word, Dogcast Radio. By email, you can contact me on julie@dogcastradio.com. When contacting us by email, if you have the facilities, please record your questions or comments and send them to us as an audio file. That way we can include them directly in our programme. We can accept most formats, for example, WAV, MP3. All these methods of contacting us can be found on our website, which is www.dogcastradio.com. And as ever, the final word goes to Jenny.
A man walked by a table in a hotel and noticed three men and a dog playing cards. The dog was playing just as well as any of the men. "That is a very smart dog," the new arrival commented. "He's not so smart," said one of the irritated players. "Every time he gets a good hand, he wags his tail."